Okay, so I think almost everyone has their exam back. Again, in green box, you should have your raw score equals the renormalized score equals a letter grade. Right below that, kind of scribbled quickly and maybe illegibly in blue, is an estimate of your current grade. So that's your homework quiz grade, three exam scores, and I just put in a 95 for lab because people usually do pretty good for lab. In the bottom in blue next to HW, that's the homework since the last exam. So if you wanted to calculate your own homework scores, you could add up all the numerators and the denominators. Yes. Phil. So I'm really happy to answer questions like, what do I need to get on the final to get grade X?
Yep.
So you can just email me those and I can email you back with a more precise grade. If you want to, you can look up your lab grade so I can do a little bit better job. Tell me what your average lab grade is as opposed to me just guessing 95. So that blue score is like 70% of your final grade, right? So there's room to change it a little bit, but not a whole lot of room. I thought the exam was going to be harder, and it was. So I think on the last exam, the high score was 64. Here, the high score was 54. But it all kind of comes out in the wash. So as a matter of fact, people on average did better on this exam than they did on the previous one, even though it was harder. By setting the high score equal to 100, I make up a lot for the difficulty of the exam. Questions? There are screencasts with the solutions.
Do you know when our final is here?
Yeah, and you can come to the other class if you want, but it's still on Monday, I forget. More questions? Say again? That's what I'm told. I don't remember. I think it's, I mean, you can look at it up online. It's still on Monday, so it's not a big difference. Yes, it's a 1 o'clock class. And if people still have conflicts, I'm open to have at least one other time to do it, but I don't want to have zillions of times. So we'll probably have a help session on the study day. And we have just one more chapter, but it's a big chapter. So there's a noticeable amount ahead. Oh yeah, so the exam will be similar to this exam, but it'll be not quite double as long because we have not quite double as much time to work it. So I don't know, maybe 20 short answer and maybe 8 long questions. If you think about it, I mean, the quiz questions are the ones that I care a lot about, and they're probably going to be fewer than 9 questions, problem type questions on the exam. So a good starting point would be to think that the exam questions are going to be similar to the quiz questions. That's not a foolproof strategy, but I think it's a start. And I'll probably go a little bit out of my way now to combine various pieces as opposed to just have questions that are purely on a particular topic. More questions?
That will be curved as well.
Oh, yeah. One piece of paper, both sides. More questions? Not due today, but there's one that's on for next time. More questions? So it's on to chapter 13. And a lot of chapter 13 we could have done long ago. It's basically back to doing stuff with springs. And so probably the best place to start is to try and remember what we knew about springs. So with springs, there's a linear relationship between how much you stretch them and how much they pull back. So currently this spring is just supporting 50 grams. If I double the weight, it's going to be stretched twice as much. And if I triple that weight, it's going to be stretched three times as much as it was originally. So the relationship we have then is that the force is minus K times the displacement. So this K is called the spring constant. And that's not something you could look up in a CRC, right? It depends on what the spring is made of, how tight the curves are. So it's something that basically has to be given as part of the exam. Here and most commonly, we have springs that are designed not to work in compression and only extension. But you know, like the springs that are on your car, there are springs that work just fine whether you compress them or whether you extend them. They would all satisfy this sort of relationship. So after forces, we talked about potential energy. And the potential energy of a spring is 1/2 kx squared. And you might remember that the potential energy, well, I should say the change in the potential energy is minus the work done by the spring. And I kind of give you warning, there are lots of problems in the book that don't talk about the work done by the spring, but done by the by how much work do we need to do in order to stretch that spring. And that's, of course, the opposite right, so whatever the work that the spring is doing is opposite of the work that I need to do in order to stretch it. And that's because of the work kinetic energy theorem. If we add up the work done by all of the forces, that has to be the change in the kinetic energy. If we just have the work done by the spring, then the total work done is just the work done by the spring, and it's going to be minus the change in the potential energy. And if we bring the potential energy to the other side of the equation, what we have is 0 equals the change in the kinetic energy plus the change in the potential energy, which is, of course, a statement of conservation of energy. Okay, so all of this stuff is old stuff that we did a couple of months ago that is being rehashed now for reasons that not exactly clear. The main purpose of this chapter is to talk about oscillations. So here we have something that's oscillating, and it's oscillating about some equilibrium point. The deviation, the maximum deviation that the spring has from its equilibrium point, that's called the amplitude. We can talk about the time it takes to complete a cycle. That's the period. We can talk about the frequency. We could count the number of cycles in a minute or something like that. Usually, since we're dealing with MKS system, we're talking about the number of cycles per second. And you might remember that we found lots of uses for this thing that was omega. It was sometimes called the angular velocity. And that was just 2 pi divided by the period. So let me give some symbols for these Capital A is usually used for amplitude. Capital T is usually used for period. Lowercase f is often used for frequency. And if you think about it, there is exactly one cycle in one period. So one formula we have for the frequency is it's just 1 over the period. So the omega could also be written as 2 pi times the frequency. Okay, so let's take kind of another look at this. If we think about plotting the potential energy versus the displacement, it's going to be a quadratic, right? It's going to look kind of like that. And we know that energy is conserved, so if I put as a horizontal line here what the total energy is, then if I'm at this position, there must be this amount of potential energy, and therefore there must be this amount of kinetic energy. So you can see, of course, that the maximum amount of kinetic energy happens when we're going through equilibrium. As we go out to the extreme amplitude A, the kinetic energy is zero because the velocity is zero, and it's going to turn around at that point and start back. It'll have a lot of kinetic energy when it goes through equilibrium, and it's going to slow down and have another turning point at minus A. So we can read off from this graph what the potential energy and what the kinetic energy is if we know what the energy is. And we can write this in kind of standard form. We know that the energy is in general made up of kinetic energy, 1/2 mv squared, plus potential energy, 1/2 kx squared. So at any particular x, I could calculate what the velocity is. And let's go through and do that. So if I multiply this whole thing through by 2, and I bring the kx squared to the other side of the equation, and I divide through by the mass, and I take the square root, so the velocity is going to be plus or minus. You remember that when we take the square root, we have two signs. And that is to say, if we're at this position, we might be going out or we might be coming in. They're both possibilities. And then we have 2 times the energy divided by the mass minus k over m times x squared. So you tell me what x is and what the energy is, and I can tell you what the corresponding speed is, up to a sign. Now, there are lots of ways of telling you what the energy is. One way to tell you what the energy is to tell you what the potential energy is when it's at an extreme, right? Because then there's no kinetic energy. If it's at an extreme and there's no kinetic energy, then this energy has to be 1/2 k times a squared. Or I could talk about the energy when we're going through equilibrium. So if x is equal to 0, this is the maximum velocity squared. So those are all equally good ways of knowing the energy. If we know what the speed is, if we know what the amplitude is, we can use all those things to calculate the energy. So we know that the maximum kinetic energy happens when x is equal to 0. So if I put x equals 0, then the velocity is a maximum. So that's what I did. So at the turning points, all of the energy is potential energy. At the equilibrium, all of the energy is kinetic energy. But it's all energy, so I can use any of those ways to calculate the energy. Now, when we have something that's oscillating back and forth, we should be thinking about sines and cosines of ways of describing it. So if I had this sort of thing, right? I start it with some displacement. We know it's going to go through equilibrium and then go to the other side. So if I were to try and plot x versus time starts out, and it's going to go to the opposite extreme, and then it's going to go back through equilibrium. So we have this sort of up-down sort of possibility. And we can write this, if we want, as a trigonometric function. So under these circumstances, x is the amplitude times the cosine of something that increases with time. So as soon as we start using trigonometric quantities, we have to be careful about what units we're using. And we have a preference to use radians. So remember to put your calculator in radian modes if you're doing these sort of calculations. So we want whatever goes in that blank, we want that to be one cycle, which is 360 degrees or 2 pi radians, when the time is one period. So if when t is equal to a period, this whole quantity is equal to 2 pi, then this missing piece must be 2 pi over the period. And that, you know, is just the same thing as omega. Okay, so we've got x is equal to a cosine of omega t. Now, cosine of omega t, things like that, we're kind of thinking about things moving in circles, right? So if we had something that was moving exactly in a circle, what is its x component? Well, if the radius of the circle is r, and if this angle is linearly increasing so that it's omega t, then this is a side that's adjacent to that angle, so this x is going to be r cosine of omega t. So you can see that that circular motion will correspond to oscillatory motion if kind of the radius of the equivalent circle is a. So another way of saying that, if I were to look up from the bottom and something was going around in a circle, it would look just like something that's oscillating. So if I have something going in a circle, from your point of view, it should look a whole lot like this thing going around and around and around. Now, the other thing we know about circular motion is that there is a centripetal acceleration, an acceleration that's towards the center of the circle. And the magnitude of that centripetal acceleration is, if you look at your old cheat sheet, it's omega squared r, where omega has to be written in terms of radians. It was one of those sorts of equations. So if we look at just the x component of the acceleration, we can see that the acceleration in the x direction is just same sort of triangle. It's omega squared r times the cosine of omega t. Except the acceleration is in the opposite direction of the displacement. So there's going to be an extra minus sign there. Okay, so for circular motion, we have an acceleration that is minus omega squared r times cosine of omega t. And we have a location that is equal to r cosine of omega t. And what Newton promises us is F equals ma. So I should be able to take the mass times the acceleration, and that should equal the force, which is supposed to be minus kx. So if I plug and chug, put in that for the acceleration and that for x, what do we get? Well, we get minus omega squared r times cosine of omega t better equal minus k times r times cosine of omega t. And the cosines are the same, the r's are the same, the minus signs are the same. Oops, I dropped my mass, right? So what's left then is omega squared has to be k over m. So if we know the spring constant and the mass, we can calculate omega. And if we know omega, we know we can calculate the frequency, or we can calculate the period of the motion. So circular motion, if you project it, is just simple harmonic motion, and we have this important relationship between the strength of the spring and how long it takes it to complete a cycle. With that, let's spend a second to kind of rewrite this equation in maybe a slightly more convenient form. So we've said that the energy could be written as 1/2 kA squared. So the 1/2 is going to go away. And I'm going to have kA squared over m minus k over m times x squared. And I hope you can see where this is going. K over m is a constant term. And when I pull it out, I'm going to get the square root, which is just omega. So I've got omega, the square root of a squared minus x squared. And I really better remember my plus and minus signs, because it could be going around one way or the other. It could be going in or out at that particular spot x. Okay. Now there's a final bit of knowledge we can get from the circular motion argument. So you know that the velocity is tangent to the circle, kind of like that. What is the x component of the velocity? And I won't go through the argument for you, but the cosine of this angle turns out to be the same as the sine of that angle. So this ends up being minus omega r times the sine of omega t. Those of you who have taken some calculus might recognize that this velocity is the derivative of this position, and this acceleration is the derivative of that velocity, which is exactly the way it's supposed to be. Okay, so there's a lot of meat on that bone. Questions? So let's see how that pans out for homework sort of questions. So we start out with kind of a simple plug and chug sort of problem. We attach a load of 50 newtons to a spring, and the spring stretches by 5 centimeters. Now we put it horizontally and it's stretched 11 centimeters. What force is required to stretch the spring by that amount? Okay, so 5 centimeters gives you 50 newtons. What does 11 centimeters give you? And of course, what has to be the case is the force divided by the stretch, that has to be a constant, namely minus k. So what we have is, if we look at this constant as kind of a F1, X1 is F2, F2, the force compared to the expansion in the first case has to be the force divided by the expansion in the second case. So the force that's required is just going to be x2 divided by x1 times f1. And since this is a ratio of things, we don't even have to convert these things to meters, right? Which, since we're in the MKS system, would be the natural thing to do. We can just, that ratio is going to be the same in centimeters. So we have 11 is to 5 as 50 newtons is, and that's one we can do in our head. 110 newtons. It's pretty easy to plot a linear function. And one thing that's kind of tricky about this is this minus sign. So first of all, let's plot it and then describe it. So that minus sign says that the slope is negative, right? If we plot it up, it's going to look like that. And I don't know, this can be, I think, confusing. If I pull this thing down, the force is up. And that difference in direction is what that minus sign is about. All that minus sign is saying is if you extend it, it's going to push it back. If you compress it, it's going to want to expand. And because that's all that's what that's saying, notice I didn't pay a lot of attention to it in this calculation, because all I wanted was magnitudes of forces. Okay, so we pull back 40 centimeters, and that takes a force that is 330 newtons. What's the spring constant? So the spring constant is just the force divided by the displacement. And if I want to be super careful, which I don't see any reason to be, but let's do it once. So if I expand the spring, I have produced a displacement that is in that direction, but the force is in the opposite direction. So if you want to get technical on me, I'm going to call that force minus 230 newtons, and I'm going to call the displacement 0.4 meters, and I know that the force over x is supposed to be minus k. The minus signs go away, and so in the end, k is just the 230 newtons divided by the 0.4 meters. So 230 and 0.4, I get 575. And the units are newtons per meter. No dead physicists have grabbed that with their name. Hooke would be a good name for it, since Hooke, this is called Hooke's Law. Okay, and under normal circumstances, I probably wouldn't have bothered with this minus sign. I would have just taken the force and divided it by the displacement and called it K. So the minus sign is, I think, something more to confuse you than to help you. So here's another minus sign that's there to confuse you. How much work is done pulling the bow? How much work does the archer do in pulling the bow? So it's not how much work the spring did, it's how much work was done to stretch the spring. And remember, that's just a difference in sign. The change in potential energy is minus the work done by the spring, but that's equal to the work that we would have to do to stretch the spring. And one way you can recognize that is if we add this together, we get zero, because there's no kinetic energy after we stretch it, right? And we know that the total work done has to be the change in kinetic energy, which is in that case zero. So these things have to add up to zero. They have to be opposites of each other. Okay, so this is just like the steam engine, where we have these minus signs that crop up, whether we're talking about the work done by the steam or whether we're talking about the work we do on the steam. And in this case, the problem says, how much work do we do? How much work does the archer do to stretch the spring? And that's just the change in potential energy. Yeah. So change is final minus initial. So I have 1/2 k, the final x value, minus the initial x value, which is zero. So I've got that. I know the value of k, because they had me calculate it in the first part. So that's 1/2 575 newtons per meter times 0.4 meters squared. Let's take a second to think about units. So what we've got is newtons per meter times meters squared. So we can get rid of one of those meters. And you might remember that the famous dead physicist Joule is named for a Newton meter. So our answer is going to be in joules, and all we have to do is square 0.4 and multiply it by half of 575. And I get 46. Seems like a surprisingly even number. Questions? Okay, so now we get to problems that have part G in them, right? So here we have a horizontal block spring system. That's one kind of like that we set up there. And it's set up on a frictionless surface. And they tell us that the energy is 47 joules. And that the maximum displacement from equilibrium, that's a complicated word for amplitude, is 0.24 meters. What's the spring constant? Well, we know someplace on this board that the energy can be written as 1/2 k a squared. So we know the energy, 47 joules. We know the amplitude, which is 0.24 meters. So we're all set to plug and chug for the spring constant. So we've got 47 joules times 2 divided by the amplitude squared. That's supposed to be the spring constant. Let's check our units before we start. So the spring constant has the energy has units of joules, and we're dividing that by meters squared. And a joule is a Newton meter, so we can get rid of one of those meters, and a Newton meter has been the units that we had for spring constant. So we seem to be barking up the right tree. So 2 times 47 divided by 0.24 squared. So I get 1632. Yeah, I did 2 here. No, that's what I got. Are we agree? No? Okay. Yeah, so it's 2 times 47 divided by 0.24 squared. What's the kinetic energy of the system at equilibrium point? So that's the same thing as the maximum kinetic energy, right? Because at equilibrium, there's no potential energy. So all of the energy is kinetic energy, so don't need to do a calculation. It's got to be the total energy, 47. We could easily ask, what's the potential energy of the system when it's at its maximum amplitude, right? If it's at its maximum amplitude, there's no kinetic energy, so all of the potential energy is going to be energy, so it's going to be 47 joules. But that's not what they asked. They asked, given that we know what the kinetic energy is, what's the speed of the block? Actually, they say they give us the speed and they're telling us the mass. So we know that energy can be written as the maximum kinetic energy. So we've got the 47 joules is supposed to be 1/2 the mass, and they're telling us that the speed was 3.45 meters squared. So apparently the mass should be 2 times the 47 joules divided by the 3.45 squared. Let's take a look at our units. So we've got joules divided by meters squared per second squared. And it better be kilograms. So a joule is a Newton meter. So we can get rid of one of those meters. And a Newton is a kilogram meter per second squared, right? MA. So we've got meter squared per second squared in the denominator. So we are actually coming up with kilograms as we would expect. So twice 47 divided by 3.45 squared. And I get a pretty big mass of basically 7.9 kilograms. What's the speed of the block when its displacement is 0.16 meters? So first of all, notice the kind of tricky use of the word speed. The velocity had that plus or minus in front of it, right? Depending upon which way it was going. But speed is the absolute value of velocity. So we don't actually have to care about that plus or minus sign. The speed is always positive. But otherwise, we're all ready to plug and chug through, take your favorite equation. Well, so many of these equations have been erased. So we had, I think my favorite version of this was we had omega times the square root of a squared minus x squared. That was the last version we had. And omega was the square root of k over m. And we've got what k is over there, 1632. And we've got a mass that we now know is 7.9 kilograms. And we know the amplitude of the motion is the 0.24 meters. And they're asking us what the speed is at 0.16. So it's a plug and chug. It's a longer plug and chug than maybe typical. So the speed is going to be the square root of 1632 divided by 7.9. And then we've got the square root of 2.4 squared minus 0.16. Ah, thank you. I was wondering about that. Okay, so 0.24 squared, 0.16 squared. Subtract them and take the square root. I don't know if it matters, but what I'm getting for this is basically 0.18. I'll save all the digits in my calculator. For k, I've got 1632 divided by 7.9, and then take the square root of that. And for that, I've got 14.4. And if I multiply those things together, I get 2.57. Now, it's usually safe just to tack the units on, but it's always smart to also check them. So that quantity is the square root of meters squared. So that by itself is going to have the units of meter. What are the units of omega? Well, one of the formulas we had for omega is that it was 2 pi over the period. So the units of omega are radians per second or just per second. So lo and behold, we are going to get meters per second when we do all of this complicated process. Okay, so you can pick your x and you can find your speed. Whether it's going in or out, the speed will be positive or negative. find the kinetic energy of the block at that particular spot. Well, that's a simple plug and chug, right? Because kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared. We know that the mass is 7.9 kilograms. And we just calculated that velocity. So all we need to do is to square that velocity and multiply it by 7.9 divided by 2. Still got that velocity sitting in my calculator. So square it, 7.9 times it, 2 divided by it, and I get 26.1 joules. What's the potential energy when it's at 0.16 meters? Well, I could calculate it, right? I could go through and calculate that the potential energy is 1/2 kx squared, and I'd be all set. But I also know that the total energy is 47 joules. And the energy comes in kinetic energy and potential energy, so if I just subtract off the kinetic energy, I could get the potential energy immediately. And so whatever that turns out to be, what, 20.9 better be what the potential energy is. I don't know if it even asked that. Oh, it did ask that. Okay, good. So there it is, 20.9. So what we've been assuming so far is conservation of energy. So now we're going to have a rough surface, which means there's friction, which means there's an additional work besides the work done by the spring, and we're going to lose energy as a result. And so they say, assume that the system was started out at 0.24 meters, and it loses 14 joules by the time it reaches its first turning point. So first of all, what do I mean by the first turning point? So in terms of kind of a picture, we're releasing it at x equals 2.4. It's going to go through zero, and we're supposed to find its new position when it turns around, which is going to be some point less than 0.24 because it has lost some energy. Okay, well, this is really just a plug and chug, right? We know that the energy at this spot is all potential energy. So it's going to be 1/2 k times this distance. I hesitate to call it an amplitude, but this distance, which is what we're trying to find. And we know that the energy is the 47 joules it started out with less the 14 joules that were used up. Right, so we've got then that x is going to be twice the new value of the energy divided by the spring constant. And we know the spring constant is 1632, so we should be all set. So we've got the 47, supposed to subtract the 14, multiply that by 2, and then divide by the 1632 and take the square root to get x. And I get 0.201. So I went through all G parts in 3 minutes. So questions on what we did? So it isn't as bad as when I plonked, whatever it was, 6 times 4 equations for you in a matrix to memorize. Right? But we still got a heap of equations, half of which are review, but we haven't used them for 2 months. So got to look them up again. Okay, so here we have the an object that's connected to a spring and it's changing sinusoidally, but instead of using a cosine, they've decided to use a sine, right? Both of those functions would show perfectly good oscillation, But just to mix it up, they've decided to use a sine as opposed to a cosine. So, of course, the difference is with the cosine function, we're assuming that it started at its maximum amplitude. With the sine function, we're assuming that we gave it a kick. It started at x equals 0, and off it's going to go. But in either case, it's going to have simple harmonic motion. Okay, so we're supposed, by looking at this equation, we're supposed to find lots of things. The easiest thing to find is the amplitude, right? We can read that off right there. Sine doesn't get any bigger than plus minus 1, so x isn't going to get any bigger or smaller than 5.2 centimeters. But we want the period and the frequency. And I think the best way of getting at this is to look at that equation and see what omega has to be. So the equation that we have is that x is equal to a cosine of omega t. And what they tell us is that x is equal to 5.2 centimeters times sine of 8 pi times t. So we've said the amplitude is pretty straightforward. And I hope it's clear that the difference between sine and cosine is basically trivial. It's just a matter of whether we're starting it from 0 or not. So it must be that 8 pi is omega. So if omega is equal to 8 pi, and we know that omega is 2 pi over the period, then the period is going to be 2 pi over 8 pi, which is 1/4 of a second. If you don't like that way of going through it, we can think about the sine function itself. To go through one cycle is to reach that point. And that point corresponds to 360 degrees or 2 pi radians. So in order to reach that point, this quantity has to go from 0 to 2 pi. So that means that to reach this time, 8 pi times that t better equal 2 pi. And we're going to get the same answer, of course. The pi's disappear. T is 2 over 8, which is 1/4 of a second. So whichever way you like best. There isn't fundamentally a big difference between sine or cosine. It's just a matter of exactly how we release the oscillation. Okay, once we've got the period, then it's easy to get the frequency, because the frequency is just 1 over the period, and 1/4 is going to be 4. In terms of units, this is just 1 over seconds. And that's perfectly good. Typically, when people have frequencies, though, they usually say cycles per second. We've gone through one cycle in, we go through 4 cycles in 1 second. And we've got some unaccounted for dead physicists. So we can call a cycle per second a hertz. Notice that omega is basically radians per second. And we're never going to call that hertz, even though radian is unitless. We're just going to use hertz for frequencies, not for anything except frequencies, even if it has the units of 1 over t. The first time after time equals 0, when the object reaches 2.6 centimeters. So let's kind of graph up what the solution looks like. So if we graph the position versus time, in this problem it's a sine function. and it has an amplitude that is 5.2 centimeters. If we make a horizontal line that's at this magic number 2.6 centimeters, we see that there are lots of occasions when the object is going to be going through that distance, right? An infinite number if it oscillates forever. And they're just asking for the first one. So what we have then is 2.6 wants to be equal to 5.2 times the sine of the 8 pi times t. So if I divide everything by 5.2, and notice there's no reason to convert these to meters because they're both in centimeters. So I have 2.6 divided by 5.2, which very nicely is equal to a half. That has to equal sine of 8 pi t. Now I need to kind of get rid of that sine. So the inverse function of sine is what I want to apply to both sides. So the inverse sine of a half is going to equal the inverse of the function, or 8 pi t. So the time is going to equal inverse sine of a half divided by 8 pi t. So I absolutely have to be in radian mode now, which I don't think I am. So I take the inverse sine of a half, and what I get for the inverse sine of a half is pi over 4, which is 0.5, or pi over 6, 0.5235. And then I have that divided by 8 and divided by pi. And what I get is t is 0.0208 seconds. Now, if we were just going to ballpark what the answer would be like, we know that this takes a quarter of a second, so this has to take an eighth of a second, so this has to take a sixteenth of a second. Yeah, so roughly speaking, we would think that this would be something like a 32nd of a second. 32nd of a second is something like 0.03, so we're in the right ballpark. Okay, each one of these quarter cycles takes the same amount of time. Good to go. Radian mode on your calculators if we're in radians.
Did we
talk about C? Yeah, we did C right off the bat. Because we can just pick off the amplitude like that. More questions? Okay, so we got another problem with G parts in it. I guess that's good because it's worth lots of points on WebAssign. So a spring of negligible mass, so what they're saying is that we only have to worry about the mass that's applied. It has a it'll stretch 3 centimeters when you apply a force of 7.5 newtons. And we're going to put a 0.5 kilogram particle on it on a horizontal surface, so just kind of like that setup over there. And we're going to stretch the spring by 5 centimeters and then release it. And there are a zillion things we're supposed to calculate. So, I remind you about the sine issue. If we stretch the spring, the force is actually in the negative direction. But kind of who cares about that? The spring constant is going to be that force divided by the displacement. So we've got 7.5 newtons. We got to convert to MKS systems. The M is meters. And we have 3 centimeters. So that's 0.03 meters. So 7.5 and divide it by 0.03. Nice round number of 250. And obviously that's in newtons per meter. What is the force count? Well, so we did that one. What's the angular frequency? So angular frequency is omega. If there's no word angular in front of it, then we're talking about the normal frequency f. And what's the period of the motion? And all of those are related, right? So omega is 2 pi times the frequency, and it's also 2 pi over t. So if you tell me what omega is, I'll be all set. And we showed that omega was the square root of k over m. And we've got k, it's 250. And they tell us that the mass is half a kilogram. So dividing by half is like multiplying by 2. So this is going to be the square root of 500. Oops. So the radian is only there as a placeholder. Remember that the radian is in fact unitless, so it would be just as good to call that per second, but it would not be good to call that hertz. If you use the word hertz, then we're talking about a frequency, not an angular frequency. Okay, so this is going to equal 2 pi times the frequency. So the frequency is going to be 22.36 divided by 2 pi. And I got the 22.6 sitting in my calculator, so I divide that by 2, and I divide it by pi, and I get 3.56. So when I write down the units of this, this radian is basically not going to be there. It may seem like I'm cheating, but radians don't have units. I would like to write this as cycles per second. Perfectly good name. But if you're a fan of dead physicists, you can write that as 3.6 hertz. So angular frequency, frequency and period. We didn't do period yet. So the period is 2 pi on top of that omega. So we have 2 pi, and we've got this 22.36. So 2 and pi, and then I want to put that on top of the 22.6, and I get a, boy, I must have made a mistake. I'm going to try it again. So I've got the 2, and I've got the pi. Yeah. Ah, I hit the wrong button. Third time's the charm. Okay, swap, divided by, and I get 0.281 seconds. And again, you might wonder what happened to that radians. And if you want, you could say this 2 pi is radians and they're canceled, but basically the radian doesn't have units, so you can drop it. What's the total energy of the system? Well, we can calculate the total energy most conveniently from the amplitude, because we have the formula that the energy is 1/2 kA squared. That is to say, when it's at its extreme, 100% of its energy is potential energy. So we've got the spring constant of 250, and we've got a displacement that is 5 centimeters. We better convert that to meters. Well, that's not much. I get 0.313 joules. Yep, that's what I got. Well, the amplitude of the motion was told us when they say that it was released from 5, right? So the amplitude is the 5 centimeters. What's the maximum velocity? So the maximum velocity we can get, because this same energy has to be 1/2 mv squared. So when we're going through equilibrium, there's no potential energy, so 100% of the energy has to be kinetic energy. So we set this equal to 1/2 m times the maximum velocity squared. So what we're going to have is 2 times 0.313 divided by the mass, which is 0.5 kg. That has to be V max squared, so we have to take the square root of all of that. I still have my 0.3 sitting here in my calculator, and I get a velocity that is 1.12 meters per second. Yes?
Should that be 0.05 in the denominator?
Oh, should it? No, I think it's half.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of hard to see, but I think it's 0.5. What's the maximum acceleration? Well, people haven't asked us for accelerations for a while. The way we usually calculate accelerations are from forces. And we know that the force is minus kx. So the maximum acceleration is going to happen at the maximum value of x, or if you want to pay attention to the minus sign, at the smallest value of x, but it amounts to the same thing. So the acceleration is going to be a maximum at k over m times the maximum displacement, which is 0.5. Right? So when this thing is the furthest over, that's when it's being pulled back the hardest. So what we've got is k, which is 250, divided by 0.5 times 0.05. I shouldn't need to do that on my calculator, but why not? And I get 25 meters per second squared. Woo, that's not what I got here. I think my notes are wrong. I don't see any mistake. Anyone see a mistake? Well, this is just a plug and chug. Maybe I'll spend a second about it, but want to go on to get to part G. So what we know is that x is equal to the displacement times cosine of omega t. And we know what omega is right there. We know that the amplitude is 5 centimeters. All we have to do is plug through the half of a second. We do want to be careful that we're in radian mode. Well, the acceleration is also pretty easy because all of them are pretty easy. So there's what we have for the acceleration, where this r is the amplitude. So what this is it's minus omega squared times x. And omega squared is just k over m. So what we have is the spring constant divided by the mass times the location, which is whatever we calculated from this result. Or we could just use directly this equation. And of course, for the velocity, we're all set to use that equation. Okay, so lots of equations, half of them are reviews. Let me take 2 minutes to remind you about the lab practical. So for the next lab period, you want to sign up as an individual. You're going to basically do the easy part of a lab all by yourself. The easy part being putting information into Excel, calculating coefficients with WAP, writing down the units and the sig figs, which you would never dare do wrong after so many attempts at doing it. This is the easiest test you can imagine because the test is online. So you can go to the website that's in your lab manual and you can do the test. Never before have I given you the test before the exam, but we're doing that for the lab practical. So the one disadvantage of that is the answers aren't online. So, I mean, you could do it, and how do you know that it's right? Well, you can email me, and I'll grade your answers. So you can check to make sure that you're doing it right. So everyone gets their 100% on the lab practical, I hope.
How much is it worth?
It's worth a lab. So the other thing that may be worth commenting on is, you remember you took a pre-test in the first week of class, so there'll be a post-test, and that'll also count like a lab.